Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In early November, I talked with Rachel Louise Snyder, who wrote the book No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. The New York Times recently named the book as one of the 10 best of the year, saying Snyder debunks pervasive myths and writes movingly about the lives and deaths of people on both sides of the equation. Rachel was the keynote speaker in November for an event at the Sacramento Family Justice Center. We've linked a conversation about the center to our webpage, too. So here's some of my talk with Rachel. She's a journalist. She wrote her book about domestic violence initially from a distance.
I had a sort of luxury that a lot of journalists have, which is that we come from the outside and try to understand something inside of it by spending, in my case, years with people who live in this reality, either victims or abusers or law enforcement or advocates. But in June, when I was in the middle of my book tour for this book, I got off the airplane to a frantic phone call from one of my oldest, dearest friends. And it turned out that her brother killed his wife and then killed himself. I stopped my book tour for a couple of weeks. She lived with me all summer. We're still sort of working through the fallout from that. They left behind two children. The oldest was one of my daughter's best friends. So my own daughter was in trauma therapy all summer. So I feel like I have personal stakes in a way that I didn't even when I was writing this book. And it just has ignited me, I think, more even than I felt before, that this has got to change, that we can do something about this.
With all you'd learned in doing the book, and your friend and her family being so close in your life, what did you recognize? Of course, I was going to ask you, or anyone would ask you, what did you see? How much of a shock was this?
You know, I think even if you recognize things, it's a shock. I think there's no way that something like this can't be a shock. I mean, everyone in my book who experienced something similar, it was a shock. I didn't know the parents that well. I knew my friend, right? So I knew that they were in the middle of a divorce and that the divorce was very messy and toxic. But apart from arranging sleepovers for their daughter, and their daughter always wanted to come to our house, they were just parents in the school that I knew. I didn't know them super well. Of course, we try now to backtrack and put things together and piece things together. And I actually can't talk about specifics too much because it's so new that it's still going, all aspects of it are still going through court probate and guardianship and all that kind of stuff. But I look at those two little girls. I just took the older one bowling a couple of weeks ago. And luckily, her aunt, my dear, dear friend who's taking care of her, is a therapist and trained in child trauma. So the girls are actually, all things considered, thriving. They're doing great at school. But they're really lucky to have that as a resource, and so many people don't.
You did not come to this topic directly. It seems that this goes back to your time in Cambodia or other countries as a foreign correspondent, and kind of this slow, maybe kind of dull realization that if all kinds of crimes were happening to women, then of course something must be happening in the home. But as you describe it, Rachel, you weren't really there yet with the awareness.
I really wasn't. And it's just astounding to me now, right? It's like looking back at the person you were when you were 15, like, how could I ever have been that person? In some ways, I'm ashamed. In other ways, I'm glad because I am teachable and curious eternally. But I did all kinds of stories that in my mind were human rights abuses, right? Women forcibly sterilized in Tibet, women imprisoned in Kabul for love crimes, child brides in countries around the world. And all of these stories had domestic violence as like sort of shadowy backgrounds, so much so that I just assumed it was there and thought, but that's not the meat of this story. This story is about this 20-year-old woman who refused to marry her, you know, brother-in-law after her husband was killed, and now she's in jail in Kabul.
So domestic violence became sort of a box that was checked on the way to some other crime or story.
Yeah. It really wasn't until I moved back to the States and met some incredible people who were able to situate it and say, wait a minute, domestic violence isn't just a shadowy background. It is, in many cases, the originator of this violence. In many cases, it is like ground zero for women. We need to tackle this if we want to hope to tackle any of these other pressing social issues.
And in 8 years plus now of work on the topic, what have you come to understand about why domestic violence, hasn't been the epidemic, hasn't been the core focus of the conversation the way it should be in the United States?
Domestic violence has sort of emerged as a national conversation once or twice in our history, and then, you know, sort of quickly been pushed to the background again, right? It emerged when Nicole Brown Simpson was killed. It emerged when the Violence Against Women Act was passed. You know, we didn't have a federal law banning spousal abuse in this country until 1984. And I think the attitude, and this is an attitude that persists across this country, the attitude is that when you put the word domestic onto the word violence, it is a woman's problem. It is a private problem.
You actually have what you think is a better phrase for it. I've heard you say that intimate terrorism is more accurate.
Although I think that terrorism as a word is troublesome for a whole lot of reasons, we have very specific associations with it. In terms of the root of terrorism, terror, that is actually what it's like living inside a home where this kind of domestic violence exists. It's about coercion. It's really not even about the physical violence. It's about the way in which an abuser takes up residence inside the mind of a victim.
I'm jumping ahead to ask you questions like, why isn't more attention focused on the abuser? Why does an abuser behave the way he, or in some cases she, does? Why doesn't he or she stop? Why doesn't he or she leave? Those questions fall so far down the list still. And are you saying a lot of it is that idea of domestic, in the home, private, women's focused issue?
I think so. I love to quote Eve Ensler, the woman who wrote the Vagina Monologues, who says, you know, domestic violence is a men's problem. We're not beating and raping ourselves. I sort of love just the turning it on its head. I do absolutely think, I mean, when I was researching this book, there was a lawmaker I heard about in Montana who was like, domestic violence is a private problem. We're not going to deal with that in our legislation. I mean, this is a recurring issue that can happen in any constellation of, you know, women can be abusers. There's significant research now being done into LGBTQ abuse relationships. There's a beautiful memoir just out by Carmen Maria Machado on her own domestic same-sex relationship abuse and that I really can't wait to read. So finally, I feel like we're getting some nuance to the conversation. Like there's still sort of, I don't know, a social marketing campaign or something that needs to say, like, this is wrong. This is wrong. And take away the stigma and the shame for victims to come forward.
Will you give me the statistic that came out just before the book was published? And let's talk about whether it's reflective of more awareness and more reporting or an increase in incidents.
That is the chicken or the egg question. Right before the book came out, James Allen Fox, and I think he's at Northeastern in Boston, put out stats, post-2017 stats on domestic violence homicide, and found that in this country, domestic violence homicides were up by 33%. It used to be that we would say there were 3 women a day killed in this country, and now it's between 4 and 5. That's a huge increase. And people have asked me, you know, what is the reason for that? And we don't have causation research yet. It's too new. But, you know, I think the Me Too movement has, I think a corollary to it is that it has enabled women to say, we're angry, we're tired of this. Not just women. I don't want to imply that only women are victims, but they are the vast majority of victims are women. And, you know, it's hard to ignore the misogynistic, patriarchal attitudes of our federal government. Some in our federal government, not all.
I'm talking with Rachel Louise Snyder. Her book is titled No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. You start the book and use the case of Michelle Monson Mosier. with her children, Christy and Kyle, and this man that she was married to, Rocky, as the place where you can dissect what happened and teach us and tell us. It's a horrific story. It would help if we had a little bit of the storyline. And then tell me what's happened since then.
Michelle was very young when she met Rocky. She was 14, pregnant by 15. And eventually, Rocky killed Michelle when she was 23, killed their two kids, Christy and Kyle, and then killed himself. And the case was monumental in Montana, where they lived. It was the first case that a group called the Fatality Review Team took on to look at places where changes could have been made in the system to keep her alive. She had a lot of sort of the classic markers of a situation of extreme domestic violence abuse. She was very isolated, not from his family, but from her family. She was not allowed to work outside the home. They had a very gendered role in the home. She took care of the kids and, you know, did the cooking and cleaning, and he worked essentially, not full time, but, you know, on and off. Part of the reason I'm telling the story of Michelle and Rocky is because through their story, I can answer some of these questions, like, why doesn't she just leave? Why don't victims come forward and engage in law enforcement or with local resources? Why don't victims tell their families what's going on? Why don't they go to shelter, right? And all of those questions, I just have to say, are all questions that are putting the impetus for change on the victim, which is also something that I address in the book and I think is wrong. I think we need to be asking, how can we intervene with him? Why is he beating her? Why is he being violent toward her?
Is it true you weren't really crazy about the subtitle of the book because it had the phrase domestic violence in it that you...
Oh, it's so true. That is that is an understatement. As you said, this is my third book. I really don't fight publishers on things. Like, you know, they send you things like, do you like the font of the inside of the book? Like, I have no feelings about the font that you choose for my book. The only thing I have ever truly, really fought was the subtitle of this book, you know, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us, because I felt like it was a way for it to be ignored, because I know that we have this association with domestic violence, because I know that it is how we can put aside the fact that we have these attitudes, right? I think of a book like Nickel and Dimed or Evicted and how they're really powerful in their storytelling, right? But this, I worried that it would be an easy way to ignore it if you were not already attuned to it, and also that, like, nobody would want to read it while they were on the train, because they would get that, you know, it's like reading, you know, Fear of Flying when you're on an airplane. You'll have the flight attendant come up and say, my God.
You know, with the title being No Visible Bruises, at first, I thought it was going to be a memoir of sorts. I thought it was going to be some sort of personal story.
I'm asked again and again if I have domestic violence history, and I always say, like, do you ask your male journalists if they also have been?
It is a perception, a judgment on its own.
Yeah.
There is a danger assessment.
Mm-hmm.
There is an actual standard out there. I don't know how well known it is or how widely used it is, but would you say that there is a tool, please?
Yes, the dangerassessment.org. Anybody can go to it and look it up. It is the 20 highest risk indicators for domestic violence homicide. I do want to caution that it is a tool that is generally used for domestic violence advocates or law enforcement, because there is certification in giving the danger assessment. And part of that certification is that you do a timeline of the relationship right along with the danger assessment. So if you're trained as an advocate, you will do that 20-question danger assessment. And in theory, you are also supposed to do a timeline with the victim to get a sense of whether or not the violence is escalating. But if you are a victim and you're worried or you are not sure, you know, a lot of people I talk to are like, you know, he controls everything I do, but I don't think it's a domestic violence situation because he doesn't, you know, punch me. He might throw plates toward the wall, or he might do some other thing that maybe isn't recognized as that, you know, the punch to the head or the kick to the ribs or whatever. The danger assessment allows you to see, really, that you're not crazy, that it is domestic violence, these things that you're facing. So I think it's a great tool. It's been around for a while. It was developed by a woman named Jacqueline Campbell at Johns Hopkins, who is really, in my view, the leading voice on domestic violence research today.
dangerassessment.org.
Dangerassessment.org.
You're listening to Rachel Louise Snyder, author of the book No Visible Bruises.
The thing we have to understand is that sometimes things like filing for a restraining order increases the violence, right? Increases the risk. We know the research tells us that the most dangerous time for any victim is when they are attempting to leave or have recently left. So there's a lot of systems where the bureaucracy can make a very complicated relationship worse in terms of risk. But also, victims very often don't go to domestic violence agencies because, and they say rightly so, why should I be the one to leave my home? I did nothing wrong, right? You don't have a burglar come into the home and call the police and the police come and say, my God, this is terrible. You've been burgled. Well, you're going to have to come with us now. The burglar is going to take up residence in your home. And that's what we're doing when we tell victims to go to shelter, really. A lot of victims reach out to their clergy members. So one of the things that I feel like is so important is to bring clergy members into any community coordinated instruction. You know, here in Sacramento, you have a former clergy member running the Family Justice Center, which is fantastic and rare. The only one I've heard of, actually. So I think that we need to train clergy. I also think there's bystander intervention research out there that people can talk about. I think the biggest thing, though, is taking away the shame and stigma. If you are a colleague, a coworker, a friend, a sibling, and you suspect that something is happening, I think you have to try to make space for victims to talk about it and to say, there's no shame here. There's no judgment here. Let's talk about what we can do.
What do you know now that you want to say to anyone who is wondering, let's start there, wondering if they're in a dangerous situation?
I think if you're wondering, it's enough to try to get out. To me, one of the hardest things is to think you are not crazy. You're not crazy. But you're also not alone. There are people who can help and will understand. You know, one of the biggest things, I'll just mention this, one of the biggest things to come out of the case of Rocky and Michelle for the state of Montana after they got together and looked at that case was they did three things to change. And these three things are so inexpensive for any community. The first is they have a dedicated domestic violence police officer. This is something you in Sacramento already have, right? So you're already ahead of the game. The second thing they did was they don't allow those arrested for domestic violence to bail out before lunch. They have to wait until after lunch to see a judge. Such a small change costs almost nothing, but what it does is it gives a domestic violence advocate or a police officer trained in domestic violence enough time to get to a victim, to do maybe a danger assessment, to do a safety plan, to change the locks, to just say to a victim, you're not crazy. That is domestic violence. You know what? If someone throws a plate against the wall and it breaks and you get cut in the cheek, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, that is domestic violence. You're not crazy. Let's fix this. The third thing they did was they created something called the Hope Card, and it's a little credit card-sized restraining order that is laminated, that has the abuser's picture on it, the areas of exclusion, the dates of the active restraining order, and victims can get as many copies of that as they need. So they can pass them out at the kids' school, for example, or to their coworkers or to their neighbors. These changes are really inexpensive. So I would say communities can do that, but what we can do as individuals is make space for people to tell their stories.
That's Rachel Louise Snyder. Her book is No Visible Bruises. You can find a link to the Sacramento Family Justice Center and Rachel's website. It's at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.